This is the first day of this January 2014 seven-day sesshin, Rohatsu seven-day sesshin. And we'll return to a text I've read from a number of times in Teisho, but not in the last 2 years or so, which is about the teachings of Korean Zen master Kusan Sunim. And it's from a book called The Way of Korean Zen. He was born in 1909 and died in 1983. He was born reading here from some biographical notes by the editor, Stephen Batchelor. Stephen Batchelor spent some time in Korea with Kusan Sunim, and then he switched to Tibetan Buddhism, and then he switched again to something else. Kusan Sunim was born near a country town in the southwest of Korea in 1909. He's born on a farm. His parents owned a medium-sized farm, and his life centered around work in the fields. His parents were Buddhist, and he attended classes at the local Confucian school. This was just the custom for many centuries. It's been the custom in China and maybe in Korea too. Anyway, he did. He studied the Chinese classics. We've heard that from many of the old Chinese masters. They began as in their youth by studying the Chinese classics. His schooling continued till he was about 15. After he left school, he continued to help on the family farm and worked as a barber until the age of 29, and he also got married during this time. So a barber until the age of 29. We're told that he had, from an early age, he had been drawn to the monastic life. When he was young, later he said, "When I was 9 years old, I remember thinking, could it be possible for someone to be without birth and death? Was it possible to have unlimited powers to move freely through the sky and on the earth? Such thoughts made me want to go and live with the monks in the mountains. But the fear of missing my parents prevented me from leaving home then." Leaving home is what means becoming a monk. "When I was 20, I also considered such a life, but I was not sufficiently determined." And then at the age of 26, he was stricken by a severe illness that caused him a great deal of pain. A friend, who was also a devout Buddhist layman, saw him in this condition and asked him, "Since the abode of the self nature is originally pure, where does your illness lie?" These words had a deep effect on Kusan Sunim. So then he decided to go to a monastery to recite the mantra of Avalokiteshvara. And that mantra is Om Mani Padme Hum. This is the primary spoken practice that I saw in Tibet. I didn't know it was done in Korea. Certainly, I never heard of it being done in Japan or China. He resolved to do this for 100 days in hopes that it could free him of his disease. And then when he completed this period, he found himself cured. And this experience, of course, strengthened greatly his faith in the Dharma. Let me just say a few words about chanting. I think it's something that doesn't come naturally to some people who come to Zen, maybe even a lot of people. The words are sometimes foreign words. We've chanted a number of our chants, we've translated them into English, but others, the Japanese Dorani, the Shosaimyo and the Daishin, we have left in the same form as we got them. The reason we didn't translate these into English is because there's only whatever translation we would give them it's not so much a really accurate translation, because the chant, those two Dharani, the power of them comes from the sound of the syllables. And so we've retained those as in the original way. And really the sound is what it's all about. When we're chanting, even with English translations, we're not trying to focus on the words or the meaning of the words. In Zen, it's not the meaning that gives the chant its power. It's the sound. And even more significant is the degree to which one can lose oneself in the chanting. This is everything. It's the practice of mu is not based on the word itself, or the supposed meaning of the word. It's how thoroughly you can lose yourself in it. So whether it's chanting in English or chanting in the Dharani or doing mu, it's all the effectiveness or the power of it all is determined by how completely one we can get with these different practices. So he must have had quite a bit of faith to do that for 100 days, and then for it to have left him cured. There's so much that we cannot explain rationally. How do you explain that in one round of sitting you can be distracted by the pain in your knees or your back or wherever, and then by making a greater effort to lose yourself in the practice, how the next round the pain can be gone? The power of mind is incomprehensible. But it rests on faith. He had faith. He wasn't thinking, well, it's just this old chant, these words. He completely threw himself. He must have completely thrown himself into this chant. And that itself, that oneness with whatever, in this case it was the chanting, but whatever, losing oneself, going beyond self-consciousness, is something that can have great healing properties. 3 years later, he became convinced that he should dedicate his life to the full-time practice of the Dharma. And to do this, he left his home and family and started traveling to various monasteries in order to find a teacher. After visiting 11 different temples, he finally came to Songguang Sa. Sa is the equivalent of, it means temple or monastery. In Japanese, it's ji, J-I. So we have Bukokuji, Sogenji, Daitokuji, and so forth. Just means Daitoku Monastery, or Sogen Monastery, or Bukoku Monastery. The Korean equivalent is Sa, S-A. And he came to this Songguang Sa, where he met the master Hyobong Sunim. Sunim is their equivalent of Roshi. He met Hyobong Sunim and was immediately convinced that this master would be a good teacher for him. From that time on, he decided to devote himself to the practice of Zen. Now, before we go further into this biographical account, let me just do a little sidebar here and relate some of the description in this book of this place, Songguang Sa, where Kusan ended up. First, the editor says that the Buddhist monasteries in Korea are usually of two kinds. They either serve as centers for the study of the sutras, or they focus on Zen meditation. Some of the larger monasteries accommodate both. One section of the monastery is used for sutra study, and the other is a closed area housing a hall for meditation. And this Songguang Sa had both. Monks undertake a postulancy period, like a novice period, for several months and receive ordination as a novice, not a full monk, but a novice. And then he's encouraged to enter either a sutra school or a meditation hall. And if he chooses the sutra school, he embarks on a curriculum of about 6 years of study. If he chooses to go the meditation route, then he enters a meditation hall and devotes himself to the practice of Zen. And he says here it is quite common for monks to go to a meditation hall after completing their study in sutras. And it says this procedure is the same for nuns as well as for monks. This Songguang Sa is situated in the southwest corner of Korea. It was established at the beginning of the 13th century by Chinul. Chinul, the name Chinul may be familiar to those of you who attended a session led by Amala Sensei, where she read from Chinul. I don't know if it was here or in Madison, but it was fairly recent, in the last year or two. It's in the middle of a more description of Songguang Sa, is reached by a narrow, unpaved road that winds gently up from the valley below. The monastery itself is nestled in a circle of steep, forested hills, insulated by nature from the disturbances of the outside world. Let me also comment here that although there is this dictum in Zen that the sage of the marketplace is a greater sage than the sage of the forest or the mountains, to have the benefit of being isolated from civilization, for Zen training is undeniable. To be isolated here at Chapin Mill from the many, many distractions and temptations of city life is a great way to strengthen one's practice. And this has always been understood, which is why most, it seems, from what I can tell, most Zen training in Asia is done in rural monasteries. Here's a bit of a description about the facility itself. The complex is formed around a spacious square courtyard. So ours is as well here at Chapin Mill, but it sounds like the one at Songguangsa is much, much larger, because it says dominating this open space is the main Buddha hall. An impressive wooden structure mounted with an imposing yet delicate Chinese-style slate roof. And this is interesting. It's quite different from Chapin Mill and Arnold Park. As with most of the temple buildings in the monastery, its walls are colorfully decorated with figures from the Buddhist pantheon, scenes from the lives of famous monks, and landscapes. The ceiling is adorned with a profusion of multicolored, interweaving patterns and motifs. Around the central courtyard are smaller temples of similar design dedicated to different bodhisattvas. So our little modest equivalent to that is the Kanon room to the west, the end of the west hall. And now behind the main Buddha hall and about 50 feet up on the hillside lies another group of buildings. This is where the meditation hall is located. Also a lecture room, a large lecture room, a couple of small temples, and the quarters of the Zen master. The area is sealed off from the rest of the monastery and is only accessible to those monks undergoing training in Zen meditation. It overlooks the entire monastery and offers a panoramic view of the surrounding hills and mountains. Once a monk has been formally accepted into the community, he then moves into the meditation hall. That's the meditation hall itself. He moves into the zendo and installs what few possessions he has in a locker. And then he's assigned to a place in one of the two rows of meditation cushions that run down the length of the hall based on his seniority as an ordained monk. So the zendo is a very linear. This was true also at one of the temples I trained at in Japan. It's long and narrow. This is where he will sit facing the wall in meditation during the day and lie down to sleep at night. The hall is uncluttered and spacious. The walls and ceiling are white. So notice the contrast here. The zendo, the meditation hall, where this work of meditation happens, is white. It's not multicolored. It's traditionally, the Buddha hall is separate from the meditation hall, and the Buddha hall is more elaborate and decorated. And this is what's interesting. In the middle of the long back wall is a small altar, okay, above which hangs a mirror symbolizing the true mind that monks seek to realize. So instead of a Buddha in the zendo, there's a Buddha in the Buddha hall, but in the zendo is a mirror. Mirror is an old symbol in Zen of this essential mind. It has in itself no images, but reflects all images. So it is form in formlessness, formlessness in form. The floor is covered with a varnished yellow ochre paper and is heated from below by a wood fire. Yeah, this is sort of the equivalent of our, what we call radiant heating, but they would actually build fires under the floor, the stone floor, to keep the, for warmth. It was probably the only source of heat, was the floor. The doors are just sliding paper screens. During the day, the room is illuminated by soft, natural light that filters through the paper doors, and after dusk, a dull electric lamp is used. The hall is suffused with an atmosphere of peace and simplicity. There are a minimum of external objects to distract the monk from his meditation. Now just pluck out some little nuggets here that might be interesting. There's the ritual shaving of the head every 2 weeks. In Japan, it's every 5 days. Every day with a 4 or a 5 in the date. Or a 9 and a 5, whatever. It's every few days. This makes much more sense to me to do it every 2 weeks. To shave your head every 5 days is a lot of fussing on yourself. In Tibet, the rule is for monks to not let the hair grow more than the width of 2 fingers. So that would be, you know, maybe even a month. And it's more common, I think, to see Tibetan Buddhist monks with longer hair like that, certainly than Japan. Japan, you better shave your head every 5 days or you might as well pack it in. And that's also the bathing schedule, only every 5 days. And now here, the day begins at 3 o'clock in the morning with a short ritual consisting of 3 bows before the altar, 3 prostrations at the altar. The start of the meditation, the round is signaled with 3 strikes of a wooden clapper. We do the bell. This is with a wooden clapper 3 times. The sittings are 50 minutes, 5-0, 50 minutes. And are broken with 10-minute sessions of walking briskly around the hall. And this goes on from 3 in the morning until 9 or 10 at night. 2 or 3 one-hour breaks are taken for the 3 daily meals, during which time the monks can also rest and go for short walks in the surrounding hills. I'm skipping most of this because I don't think it's important for Sesshin. The only formal meal is at lunch, and that's the only one where the monks wear their robes and have chanting. And the discourse by the master is just every 2 weeks on the days of the full moon and the new moon. That's when the monks assemble in the lecture hall. And here's their version of Doksan. Whenever a monk wishes to see the master in private to discuss some aspect of his practice, he is encouraged to visit him in his quarters. He may then report on the progress or hardships he is experiencing in his meditation and receive advice on how to proceed. Sometimes the monks are called one by one to the master's room in order to formally give an account of their practice. However, regular interviews at which the master keeps a close check on the progress of the student's meditation are not common in the Korean tradition. So there's another difference. All right, now let's go back to the account of the biographical account of Kusan Sunim. So he lands at Songgwangsa. He feels an immediate affinity with this master Hyobong. And now the editor here hits the pause button and talks about the life of this master Hyobong. He was born in 1888. As a young man, he studied law, and during the Japanese occupation, he was the first Korean who was permitted to become a judge. Since many Koreans strongly resisted the Japanese rule, he was often forced to pass judgment on fellow countrymen accused of anti-Japanese activities. You can imagine what a source of conflict this would have been for him to impose judgment on his fellow Koreans who were resisting the Japanese occupation. Enormously unpopular and long occupation, by the way. After he had been a judge for 10 years, a case came up in which he was forced to sentence the prisoner to death. And this passing of judgment caused him to question deeply what right he had to impose punishment on others. And then in turn, he began to doubt the validity of the entire legal system and the society that supported it. And so one day he finally decided that he could no longer continue as a judge. And without telling anyone, he suddenly left his work and home, and he became a wandering toffee seller. Yeah, we know a lot of those. I wanted to make sure I knew what it was, and yeah, it's a type of taffy. So it must be popular in Korea. So for the next three years, he drifted through the country, barely supporting himself by selling toffee. All this time, he was reflecting upon how he could lead a true and honest human life. So this is kind of a gestation period for this Hyobong. Remember, I'm talking about Kusan Sunim's master here, not Kusan himself, where he came to this dark night of the soul, probably you could call it that, some kind of a spiritual crisis that lasted 3 years, where he was just had lost his bearings. And he finally decided to enter a monastery and practice meditation. And he was 39 at the time when he received ordination. For many years he stayed in retreat, concentrating solely on resolving the koan mu. When he was 43, he built himself a tiny hermitage and sealed himself inside. This is something you also read about in the Buddhist monastic tradition. It's more common, I think, in the Tibetan tradition, where they'll seal themselves into some little hole in the rock. He left just one small hole in the wall through which food could be passed in and out. Yeah, you're sealed in, all right, but you're dependent on, of course, on the help of others, or at least one other. That's how you survive. So you have to find someone who will support you, respect you enough to support you and bring you your food. For 1.5 years he remained in complete solitude. Finally, his mind's eye opened and he realized that at last all of his doubts had been resolved. And he wrote a verse. At the bottom of the ocean, a deer hatches an egg in a swallow's nest. In the heart of a fire, a fish boils tea in a spider's web. Who knows what is happening in this house? White clouds float westward. The moon rises in the east. So during the next 30 years, this master Hyobong became widely known and a respected teacher, and he's eventually appointed the spiritual head of the main order of Korean Zen, the Chogye order. And now let's get back to Kusan Sunim. When Kusan met this Hyobong, he told him he wished to become a monk and asked him to accept him as his disciple. Master Hyobong agreed and gave him the koan mu. You know, it's translated here as no, but there's no doubt but that it's the mu koan. And to understand the word mu as just meaning no is misleading. And that's the whole point. What is mu? It's not just no. I once read a book of linguistics that one of the entries in that book was from all different cultures, and one was the word mu, and the guy defined it linguistically to mean it's not what you think. Now that's more like it. It's not what you think. So 8 months later, Kusan received novice ordination and entered the meditation hall in Songwangsa. And then at the age of 31, he became a full bhikshu or monk, celibate monk. From the beginning, we read, Master Kusan was only interested in the practice of Zen, and he never attended a sutra school to study Buddhist sutras. And these are his own words. I chose to enter the Zen school because I thought that through meditation I would be able to free myself from birth and death and gain the power to transform this world into a Buddha realm. In the sutra schools, one is only told about cultivating the mind and awakening. I felt it would be better to actually realize these things instead. Well, surely no one in this room needs to have that explained, that you would rather have the direct experience of awakening rather than reading about it, studying it, hearing about it. And he started off with a bang. These are his words. When I started meditating, I was firmly convinced that I would be able to complete the practice within the 3 months of the first retreat period. They had these, what the Japanese call ango, which are alternating what we used to call on periods and off periods. So 3 months of more intensive practice followed by 3 months of less intensive practice. Or more commonly, those off periods would be periods of, for pilgrimages to other monasteries. I exerted myself to the point where I no longer cared whether I lived or died. But as the 3 months drew to an end and I had still not realized my goal, I wanted to die since I felt it was no longer worth living. once while doing standing meditation in order to prevent drowsiness. This is what they allowed in the Korean monasteries, is if you find yourself overcome by drowsiness, you could stand up and stand still, and that way you would be sure to stay awake or make quite a commotion. I thought of drowning myself or throwing myself off a high cliff. But at that very moment, a huge snow-capped mountain appeared before me. This is, of course, a makyo. This made me remember that the Buddha had practiced for 6 full years at the feet of such mountains. I then realized that it was somewhat presumptuous for me to want to complete my training in 3 months. Thereupon, I renounced my intention to die and redoubled my efforts. So he came to his senses. So in that, it's always this double-edged sword of strong willpower. It's a great thing to have strong willpower, strong resolve. But it is up to a certain point, it is always contaminated by strong ego. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do this. It's a very tricky thing. What you want is the aspiration without the I. This is how we refine our practice over the years, is we drain the I out of it and we're left with just the pure aspiration. I heard a story from Tangen Roshi at Bukokuji that as a young man during Yaza, he would go out and he would lash himself to a tree and through the night bellowing moo. Later, 20 or 30 years later, in commenting on that, he said, "Too much ego." During the following years, Kusan Sunim continued to pursue his practice of meditation. After spending a number of seasons in meditation halls, he decided that he needed the solitude of a hermitage in order to be able to concentrate himself fully on his practice. And then he did that. He went to small, remote hermitages. And these are his words. "At these times, when I was hungry, I would find something to eat. When thirsty, I would drink. When the room was cold, I would light a fire under the floor. I tried to practice as hard as I could and would sleep very little." In those days, his disciples reported that he was very stern, even frightening figure. He would demand exemplary conduct from all the younger students of his teacher and urge them to work hard all day and meditate through the night. He would constantly remind them that they never knew when they might die, that they would be finished should the mere breath in their nostrils come to a stop. If a young monk were to waste a few grains of rice, as a punishment, he would sometimes make him go without food for the rest of the day. He himself was a devoted disciple to his teacher and a tireless worker. And then his first breakthrough occurred after he'd been meditating continuously for 7 days with the intense resolve to awaken before the memorial ceremony for a close friend who had suddenly died. However, he did not consider this a true awakening. This is what we would call getting through your koan. It's entering, in the translation of the Chinese is entering the first gate. And this is what he said. While meditating, such experiences sometimes happen. You could say it was a certain opening of the mind's eye. It was the transition over a difficult step that enabled me to first gain admittance to the door. Perhaps you could call it an initial breakthrough. It showed that my practice was progressing well. We don't know how much later in life he was framing it this way. He may have thought at the time that it was a big deal, but later he saw that, yeah, it was no crowning experience by any means, but that it was a turning point. And that's the real value of this initial breakthrough. As shallow as it may be, it grounds you in faith in a way that has not been the case up to then. Now you know. You know, it's like looking up in the sky at night, on a cloudy night, and suddenly the clouds part and you just get a peek of the moon there. And then, let's say, they close up again. Well, now you're on a new basis. It's not just having heard that there's a moon up in the sky. Now you've seen it. And even though it's not bright, it's not full, now you've seen it. And that can make such a difference in stabilizing one's practice and really fortifying one's faith. He then went to another small hermitage that he had built. He stayed there for 3 years, and in 1946 he experienced a major breakthrough. This occurred after he had entered a state in which for 15 days he lost any sense of the outside world. He was so absorbed that birds would come and sit on his head and shoulders and take pieces of stuffing that protruded from his padded coat for their nests. You can imagine how still, how absolutely still he must have been. And after this, he came down to the main temple and delivered a formal Dharma discourse to the monks. And then political circumstances interfered. The Korean War broke out. Communist forces overran the monastery and took all the monks prisoner. Except Kusan Sunim and Master Hyobong managed to avoid capture. I'm just going to skip over this lightly. It's not so important in terms of Sesshin. They went and lived in a small temple until the end of the war. And then Kusan Sunim became a leader, a national leader in Korean Zen. He accepted a number of administrative positions. This is not something that many people in Zen really crave, is becoming responsible for the administration of a monastery or temple. But it's, of course, essential. It has to be done. Someone, when a temple reaches a certain size, you've got to have someone who's willing to do the hard work of keeping it all organized and keeping the money coming in to keep it going. In these big monasteries in China and Korea, the administrative head of the monastery would be different than the teacher, the main teacher. Now this is where it gets interesting. However, he still felt that his practice of meditation needed to be deepened. This is after a major breakthrough. So he resigned his posts and went to another small hermitage. 3 years there of that, and he underwent another awakening. And this, when he reported this to his master Hyobong, he received Dharma transmission. And then he came out of, in 1962, he came out of retreat and accepted the position of abbot at another monastery where this Master Hyobong was teaching. He was there for 4 years. And then in 1966, he went abroad for the first time and to attend an international Buddhist Sangha conference in Sri Lanka. He made a pilgrimage to a number of Buddhist holy places in Southeast Asia, India, and Nepal. And after he got back, this Master Hyobong passed away. And the following year, Kusan Sunim moved to Songguang Sa. That's his original monastery where he was ordained. And then he got into what seems to have been the work of many of these famous masters, is rebuilding the principal meditation hall. In 1970, the work was completed. And then he gave an inaugural speech on the occasion of the completion of the rebuilding. And he exhorted the monks who were present with these words: "In practicing meditation, you should be prepared to grab hold of the blade of a sword so sharp that it cuts through hairs merely blown against it. You would normally be afraid to take hold of such a sword even by its handle, since at the slightest slip you would be in danger of cutting yourself. Now you have to be prepared to seize it by the blade. Could you possibly do that in your ordinary frame of mind, that is, a state of separation, self and other? As long as you are afraid of the sharpness of the blade, you are bound to cut yourself. But in firmly gripping the blade with an utterly intrepid mind, you will not even be scratched." This is a metaphor, of course, for the courage necessary to endure and prevail over the trials of serious, serious practice. And we all know what those trials are: the physical pain, the mental strain, the emotional pain, sometimes the discouragement, even the despair. As long as we are self-consciously concerned about our own welfare, then these things will be obstructions. The key, the secret, is to have such utter, complete faith in our practice, whatever our particular practice is, mu or whatever it is, that we just can abandon ourselves to this practice and not be thinking about our pain, this pain, that pain, whatever. And this is another significant thing that you see as a kind of a natural evolution, that some of the koans will highlight, where at an older age, the master who was so fierce in his younger days becomes more mellow. During his later years, the wrathful demeanor for which he was noted earlier in his life gave way to a kind and compassionate nature that always seemed to have room for any monk or layperson who was in need of his advice. You know, if you meet a Zen teacher advanced in years, or you hear stories about them, you might hear and see someone of certainly simplicity, but also, kindness, even tenderness. And you can fail to see the enormous strength underneath that, the uncompromising vigor with which the teacher practiced in his earlier life, the standards, the demands that he would impose on himself and others. Zen Master Dogen once was asked, what is the purpose of Zen practice? And he said, to develop a tender heart. Underneath that tenderness is steel, iron. Roshi Kapil used to say this is the ideal in Zen, is to become someone who is flexible, kind, tender on the outside, but iron in the inside. That is, able to endure anything, able to hold up under the most painful, most difficult, adverse conditions. So in September of 1983, he began to show signs of illness. And he had one of his disciples write down his Nirvana poem. That's just a conventional way of referring to one's death poem. And this was the poem. The autumn leaves covering the mountain are redder than flowers in spring. Everything in the universe fully reveals the great power. Life is void, and death is also void, empty. Absorbed in the Buddha's ocean seal samadhi, I depart with a smile. The following day, he gathered his disciples in his room and said he would not be living much longer. And from that point, his health gradually deteriorated, and he confined himself to his own quarters and then quietly passed away in the meditation posture at the age of 74. His body was cremated in a small field behind the monastery. His bones were ground to powder and scattered near the site of his old hermitage at the foot of Mount Chogye. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.